Welcome to our deep dive into Plato's Timaeus. It's a dialogue that's not just about Atlantis, but a journey through ancient Athens and Egyptian wisdom and some seriously profound ideas about the
Yeah,
universe.
it's a real philosophical feast. You've given us this text because you're interested in Plato's vision of an ideal society, his thoughts on cosmology, and of course that legendary island Atlantis.
Yeah, we're going to unpack it all, starting with Socrates and his companions, Timaeus, Critias, and Hermocrates, as they discuss the perfect state.
Right.
It's kind of like eavesdropping on one of the most intellectually stimulating conversations in history.
It gets juicy right off the bat. Socrates describes a society divided into classes, farmers, artisans, and warriors, each playing a crucial role. But then he throws a curveball, suggesting that the warrior class should have shared wives and children.
Wait, shared? That sounds complicated. What was Plato thinking?
Well, he believed that personal possessions and family ties could create conflicts and division. By removing those sources of tension, especially for the warrior class, the state would be unified and stronger. Imagine a society where everyone is working towards a common goal without the distractions of personal gain or family drama.
I can see how that might work in theory, but it definitely raises some eyebrows. It seems like Plato was really trying to push the boundaries of conventional thinking.
He was. And just when you think it can't get more thought-provoking, Critias steps in with a story that blows everyone's minds. A tale passed down from Solon, one of the wisest men of ancient Greece.
Okay, I'm hooked. Tell me more about this Solon guy and his epic story.
Solon was traveling in Egypt, eager to learn about their ancient history. He met with a priest in Sais, a city known for its wisdom and deep connection to the past. This priest, realizing how young the Greeks were in comparison to the Egyptians, shared a tale that spanned thousands of years.
Yeah, I love the image of this wise old priest humoring Solon, like, oh, you young Greeks, you think you've seen it all.
Exactly. And the priest emphasizes something crucial: the cyclical nature of civilizations. He says societies rise and fall, experience destruction and renewal, a pattern repeating throughout history.
That's pretty profound, especially considering how many empires have come and gone since then. It makes you wonder what lessons we can learn from those cycles.
That's the beauty of Plato. He makes you think. So the priest tells Solon about a time 9,000 years prior, when Athens was a shining example of virtue and power, with a constitution superior to any other work.
Wow, 9,000 years. That's even before the pyramids, right? So, what made this ancient Athens so special?
The priest describes a society where wisdom and virtue were highly valued and the citizens lived in harmony with each other and the natural world. It was a true golden age. But then he introduces the legendary island of Atlantis.
Here we go, the lost city. What do we learn about it from this Egyptian priest?
He describes Atlantis as a vast empire, larger than Libya and Asia combined, controlling territories that stretched beyond the Straits of Gibraltar. It was a powerful and wealthy civilization, but their ambition eventually led them to try and conquer lands within the straits, including Athens.
So it was a clash of titans, the virtuous Athenians versus the mighty Atlanteans.
Exactly. And despite being outnumbered, the Athenians managed to defeat the Atlantean forces, safeguarding their freedom and the freedom of others within the straits. It's a moment of triumph for Athens, a testament to their courage and strength.
But I have a feeling this victory is short-lived, right? That whole cyclical thing the priest mentioned earlier.
You're picking up on the foreshadowing. The priest describes a catastrophic event, violent earthquakes and floods, that swallowed Atlantis whole in a single day and night.
Wow, gone just like that. What a dramatic turn of events.
He explains that this cataclysm left behind impassable mud shoals in the ocean, all that remained of a once mighty island, now lost beneath the waves. The story leaves Socrates in awe, and he praises its power and significance.
I can imagine. It's a chilling reminder of the fragility of civilizations, even those that seem invincible. And it sets the stage for some serious reflection on what makes a society truly great.
Absolutely. And just as we're absorbing the weight of this tale, the group turns to Timaeus, the astronomer. It's his turn to take the stage and guide us through the creation of the universe itself.
Okay, so we're going from a lost city to the birth of the cosmos. This dialogue sure covers a lot of ground.
Fasten your seatbelts. Timaeus is about to drop some serious knowledge bombs. He starts by invoking the gods, emphasizing his desire to speak with clarity and accuracy.
I appreciate that. Trying to understand the origins of the universe can get pretty mind-bending.
Right. And he jumps right into a big question. Why did the Creator make a world of constant change and generation? Why not something static and unchanging?
That's a question that's puzzled philosophers for ages. What's Timaeus's take on it?
He argues for a benevolent creator, one who desired goodness for all things. He describes the world as a living being, infused with a soul and intelligence, crafted in the image of the eternal and perfect.
So the universe isn't just some random collection of matter. It's a living, breathing entity.
That's the idea. Timaeus then dives into the essential elements, fire, earth, water, and air. He explains how the Creator brought them together in perfect harmony and proportion, creating a symphony of existence.
It's like a cosmic recipe with each ingredient carefully measured and balanced to create something truly magnificent.
Exactly. And then he gets into the spherical shape of the world, highlighting its perfection. He explains that the sphere encompasses all other shapes, reflecting a unity and completeness that mirrors the divine order.
It's interesting how he connects geometry to the very nature of the universe. There's a sense of order and harmony woven into everything.
And he even tackles the question of why the world doesn't have features like eyes or ears. It's a thought-provoking point. There's nothing outside of itself for the world to perceive. It exists in its own perfect completeness.
That's a pretty profound concept. It makes you think about the limitations of our own perception, how we're confined to this physical world.
And just when you think you've grasped the enormity of his cosmological vision, Timaeus unveils the creation of the world's soul, a concept that's both complex and captivating.
Okay, world soul, I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
He talks about a mixture of the indivisible, the divisible, and essence,
okay,
all perfectly blended in precise mathematical proportions. Think of it like this. The indivisible represents eternal and unchanging forms, while the divisible represents the constantly changing material world. And essence is what binds them together, creating the soul that animates the entire universe.
So it's not just a physical universe, but one that's also infused with this invisible animating force.
That's what Timaeus is suggesting. And this world soul, he explains, is the ruler and mistress of the entire physical universe. It existed before the material world, shaping and guiding everything with its inherent reason and harmony.
It's making me think about the invisible forces that shape our lives, the things we can't see or fully comprehend, but that have a profound impact on our existence.
Exactly. And what's even more incredible is how Timaeus describes how this world soul interacts with everything that have essence. Recognizing similarities and differences, understanding the interconnectedness of all things.
Okay.
It suggests that everything in the universe is part of this grand cosmic dance, orchestrated by the world soul.
So we're all connected, even to the stars and planets.
That's the implication. And it leads us to Timaeus's next point, the creation of time. He explains that time was born simultaneously with the heavens, acting as a mirror reflecting the eternal nature of the Creator.
Time itself has a beginning. That's mind-boggling.
It is. Think of it like a cosmic clock set in motion, marking the passage of existence.
Yeah.
And those celestial bodies, the sun, the moon, and the five wandering stars, planets as we know them, were created to distinguish and preserve the numbers of time.
So the movements of the stars and planets are what create days, nights, months, and years. It's like a giant celestial calendar.
Exactly. And Timaeus even mentions the concept of planetary conjunctions and oppositions, events that have fascinated astronomers for centuries. He points out that most people don't pay much attention to the cycles of those wandering stars, missing out on a deeper understanding of time.
So there's more to time than just what we can see with our own eyes. There are these hidden cycles and patterns at play.
That's right. And Timaeus highlights the importance of looking beyond the immediate, to observe the grander patterns of the universe.
Yeah.
He says the perfect year is achieved when all eight revolutions, the sun, moon, and five planets are completed together, a moment of cosmic harmony.
Imagine witnessing that celestial alignment. It would be a breathtaking reminder of the intricate design of the universe.
Absolutely. But hold on tight, because we're about to delve into a section that sparked endless debates and interpretations, the creation of the gods and mortals. It's a tale that blends mythology and philosophical insight, raising questions about the nature of divinity and humanity.
All right, let's dive into this divine mystery. I'm curious to see how Timaeus explains the origins of the gods and us mere mortals.
And that's where we'll pick up in part two of our deep dive.
Okay.
Stay tuned for more cosmic revelations and philosophical insights.
Welcome back to our deep dive into Plato's Timaeus.
We left off with Timaeus about to unveil the creation of the gods and mortals.
It's a topic that's both fascinating and a little daunting. Where do we even begin to unravel a mystery like that?
Well, Timaeus acknowledges that understanding the full story of the gods is beyond human grasp.
Right.
He suggests we rely on the traditions passed down from those who claim to be the offspring of the gods.
So a mix of mythology and philosophical reasoning.
Exactly. He seems to respect those ancient traditions, while acknowledging the limits of human knowledge. According to these traditions, the primordial deities Oceanus and Tethys, representing the vastness of the oceans, were the children of Earth and Heaven.
It's interesting how ancient cultures often use nature metaphors to explain the origins of the universe.
And from Oceanus and Tethys sprang other generations of gods, Phorcys, Cronus, Rhea, Zeus, Hera, names that might sound familiar from Greek mythology.
Ah, so we're starting to see the connection to the stories we know and love.
But here's where it gets interesting. Timaeus describes how the creator addressed these divine beings, revealing that they're not completely immortal.
Wait, the gods aren't immortal. That's a twist.
They're incredibly long-lived, but not indestructible. The creator explains that anything bound together can be undone, but only an evil being would want to unravel something so harmonious and happy.
So it's more about the inherent order of the universe rather than absolute immortality.
Right. And what about us mortals? Where do we fit into this grand scheme? Well, the creator tells the younger gods that three tribes of mortal beings remain to be created. Without them, the universe would be incomplete, lacking the full spectrum of life.
So we're essential to the cosmic balance. I like that. But why didn't the creator just create us directly?
Good question. The creator realized that. If mortals were made directly by them, we'd be on par with the gods, disrupting the natural hierarchy. So the younger gods were given the task of crafting human beings, using a blueprint provided by the creator.
It's like a cosmic delegation of creative power. I wonder what kind of blueprint the creator handed over.
Well, the creator offered to sow the immortal part of the human soul, the divine spark that sets us apart from other creatures. The younger gods were then instructed to weave the mortal aspects into this immortal core, shaping our physical bodies and guiding our earthly journey.
So it's a collaboration with the creator providing the essence and the younger gods acting as skilled artisans.
Exactly. And to ensure balance, the creator gave specific instructions. Ooh. Each soul is to be sown into instruments of time. Think of them as cosmic wombs. And will emerge as the most religious of animals.
Religious in what sense? You mean like worshiping specific gods?
Not exactly. It's more about having an innate reverence for the divine order, an understanding of our place in the cosmos.
So we're born with this inherent connection to something greater than ourselves.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
But the creator also recognized that. Once implanted in physical bodies, we'd be subject to the challenges and temptations of the material world.
Right.
We experience joy and sorrow, gain and lose parts of ourselves.
It's the full spectrum of the human experience, the ups and downs that make life so complex.
Exactly. And to navigate these complexities, the creator ensured every human soul has the capacity for sensation. We feel love, pleasure, pain, fear, anger, emotions that color our existence.
So it's a mixed bag, this human experience. We have these amazing gifts, but also the potential for darkness and suffering.
It's a delicate balance. The creator emphasizes that if we conquer our negative emotions, we live righteously. But if we're consumed by them, we stray from the path of virtue.
There are consequences to our actions, even on a cosmic level.
Right. And here's the kicker. Those who live well during their allotted time return to their native star, experiencing a blissful existence. It's a cosmic reward for a life well-lived.
A return to the source, emerging with the divine. That's a beautiful concept.
But what if we don't quite hit the mark? The creator explains that. Those who fall short might be reborn as a woman, and if they continue on a path of wrongdoing, they might even be transformed into an animal that reflects their negative qualities.
So actions have consequences that can ripple across lifetimes.
It's a concept that encourages us to strive for virtue, knowing that our choices shape not only this life, but also future incarnations. Now, with the blueprint laid out, how did the younger gods actually craft our physical forms?
Yeah, let's get into the nitty-gritty of how we came to be these walking, talking beings.
Get ready for a fascinating journey into the intricate details of human anatomy, as Timaeus reveals the divine craftsmanship that shaped our physical existence.
I'm all ears. Let's see what Plato has to say about the miracle of the human body.
Timaeus describes the younger gods imitating the spherical shape of the universe by crafting a spherical head, the most divine part of our being, housing the brain, the seat of intelligence.
So even within our own bodies, there's this reflection of the cosmic order.
And to prevent this head from tumbling about, they gave us a body with limbs.
Arms and legs, allowing us to explore the world guided by our heads, the vessels of the divine spark within us.
Timaeus then dives into the details of our senses. Starting with the eyes, he describes them as channels of fire, allowing us to perceive light and color.
Channels of fire? That sounds a bit intense. How did he explain that?
He believed that pure fire from within us flows through our eyes, meeting the external light, creating the sensation of vision. It's a poetic way of describing the complex process of sight.
And it highlights how we're not just passive observers of the world. We're actively engaging with it through our senses, even emitting something of ourselves.
Exactly. And he doesn't stop at vision. He talks about hearing, explaining that sound is created by motions transmitted through the air, striking our ears and producing sensations.
So the air becomes a medium for communication, carrying voices and melodies to our ears.
And Timaeus doesn't just describe the mechanics of these senses. He explains why the gods gave them to us.
Oh, I'm curious. What's the divine purpose behind our ability to see and hear?
He argues that sight was given to us so we could contemplate the heavens, observing the movements of the stars and planets, leading us to a deeper understanding of time and the cosmos.
So by looking up at the stars, we're not just admiring their beauty. We're also engaging in philosophical inquiry, connecting to the divine intelligence that created the universe.
And hearing, he says, allows us to listen to speech, engage in dialogue and philosophical discussions, using language to refine our understanding of the world.
So our senses are gateways to knowledge and wisdom, helping us connect to the divine order.
Beautifully put. But Timaeus reminds us that creation isn't solely the work of divine intelligence. There's also necessity, the constraints of the material world, playing a role.
It's like a dance between the ideal and the real, the perfect forms and the limitations of matter.
And to illustrate this interplay, he dives into a detailed explanation of the four elements. Fire, earth, water, air, describing their properties and how they interact.
He talks about them almost like building blocks, combining in different ways to create the diversity of matter we see around us.
Yes, and he emphasizes the importance of shapes, particularly triangles, as a foundation of all matter. Different types of triangles come together to form the structures of the elements.
So it's like a microscopic geometry lesson in every object we encounter.
And he connects these geometric shapes to sensory experiences.
Okay.
Sensations like hot and cold arise from the interaction of these different shapes with our bodies.
So the shape of fire particles, for example, is what makes it feel hot.
Precisely. It's not just about the elements themselves, but how they change and transform. Timaeus explains how fire can dissolve earth, water can extinguish fire, air can be compressed into water, a constant dance of creation and destruction.
It reminds me of the cyclical nature of civilizations we talked about earlier. Everything in the universe is in a state of flux.
That's a great connection. And he doesn't shy away from the messier aspects of this process, even describing the formation of things like rust, copper, and glass.
He's not just focused on the grand principles, but grounded in the observable world.
Exactly. And this exploration of the material world leads us to the creation of the human body and the relationship between the soul and the physical form.
Okay, we're back to the big question. How did those younger gods actually combine the mortal and immortal aspects of the soul to create us?
This is where things get really intricate. Timaeus starts by emphasizing the importance of probability, urging us to embrace the most likely explanations even if we can't achieve absolute certainty.
So even when dealing with the divine, there's room for scientific inquiry and a bit of humility.
He then explains that. To minimize pollution of the divine, the gods decided to house the mortal part of the soul separately from the immortal part.
Like a separation of powers within the human being.
Exactly. They created the neck, a physical barrier between the head, housing the immortal soul, and the chest and lower body, which contain the mortal soul.
It's a symbolic representation of the tension between our higher and lower natures. The neck becomes this bridge between our divine aspirations and earthly desires.
A powerful image, right? And Timaeus explains that the immortal soul residing in the head is responsible for thought, reason, and understanding.
So the head is the seat of our higher consciousness, our connection to the divine realm.
And the mortal soul, housed below, is responsible for emotions, appetites, instincts.
Okay.
What he describes as a wild animal chained up with man, needing nourishment, but also needing to be kept in check.
The animalistic side of our nature that can pull us away from our higher purpose.
And recognizing this potential for conflict, the gods gave us the liver.
The liver? What does that have to do with anything?
Timaeus presents it as a battleground for the soul. It acts like a mirror reflecting the thoughts and emotions of the immortal soul.
Okay, I'm listening.
When we experience negative emotions, like anger or fear, the bitter part of the liver becomes activated, producing bile, creating sensations of discomfort and unease.
It's like our body signaling that we're straying from the path of virtue.
Exactly. And when we experience positive emotions, when our thoughts are aligned with the divine order, the liver becomes smooth and sweet, promoting well-being.
Our physical and mental health intertwined, reflecting the state of our soul.
And from here, Timaeus goes on to describe the creation of bone, flesh, and sinew, starting with marrow, the essence of life, formed from a blend of the four elements.
The marrow is like the foundation of our physical existence.
Yes, and within the marrow, he says, the gods planted our souls, encasing it in a shell of bone, crafted from pure earth, kneaded with fire and water.
Our bones, guardians of our very essence, shielding our souls from harm.
But bone alone would be too brittle.
Right.
So they created sinews, a blend of bone and unfermented flesh providing flexibility and strength. Then flesh, a mixture of earth, fire, and water, acts as a protective layer, shielding us from the elements.
Our bodies, these incredible feats of engineering, designed for both resilience and adaptability.
And Timaeus even explains the purpose of hair, a light covering for the head,
Providing
shade in summer and warmth in winter, without hindering our perception.
Every detail serving a purpose, a testament to the intricate design and care that went into our creation.
He then focuses on our hands, highlighting their intricate structure and importance for interacting with the world. Foreseeing our needs, the gods even crafted the rudiments of nails within our fingers.
It's like they were thinking ahead, anticipating our evolutionary journey, equipping us with the tools to thrive.
And to address the challenge of our bodies wasting away. Due to the constant interplay of fire and breath, the gods created plants.
Plants. Our sustenance is also a form of life, created specifically to support us.
Timaeus explains that plants possess a third kind of soul, one that experiences pleasure and pain but lacks reason or opinion. They're rooted in place, providing a steady source of nourishment for us mobile beings.
It's a beautiful example of interconnectedness, each life form playing a role in the grand scheme of existence.
To ensure the distribution of nourishment, the gods created a network of channels, our veins. Two hidden channels running down the back carry vital fluids, and veins around the head sending sensations from both sides of the body to be processed.
My body is starting to feel like a divinely crafted masterpiece, a testament to the intelligence and care that went into its creation.
And Timaeus continues, describing the digestive system, a network of fire and air in our bellies for breaking down food and absorbing nutrients.
A perfectly orchestrated dance of elements keeping us alive.
He even explains breathing. The inflow and outflow of air coupled with the movement of fire within us, helping to distribute moisture and sustain life.
It's amazing how he connects these bodily processes to things like medical cupping glasses, swallowing, even the physics of sound.
He's weaving a tapestry of knowledge, connecting seemingly disparate phenomena through divine craftsmanship.
So we've covered the creation of the universe, the gods, mortals, and even the intricate workings of our bodies. What's next on this philosophical journey?
Well, now that we understand how these amazing bodies work, Timaeus turns to the inevitable reality of aging and the decline of our physical forms. And that's where we'll pick up in part three.
Welcome back to our deep dive into Plato's Timaeus.
We left off with Timaeus talking about aging.
Right, the decline of these physical forms. Even divinely crafted vessels are subject to wear and tear, I guess.
Well, Timaeus connects it to the elements. He argues that disease arises when that natural balance of the four elements within us gets disrupted.
Okay, so we've got earth, fire, water, and air. Too much of one, not enough of another, that's where things start to go wrong.
Exactly. Think of it like a recipe. If you add too much salt, the dish is ruined. Same with the body. Too much fire, we might get fever or inflammation. Too much water, we get sluggishness or phlegm buildup.
It's making me rethink that extra cup of coffee I had this morning.
And it's not just about the quantity of each element, but also the type. Timaeus explains, there are different types of fire, for example. One creates warmth, another causes burning and pain.
So even fire, which we usually think of as destructive, has a role to play in a healthy body, as long as it's the right kind of fire.
That's right. And he's very clear that when the blood isn't properly nourished by good food and drink, that's when disease sets in.
So diet plays a crucial role. What else does he emphasize?
He stresses the importance of understanding the natural order of the body.
Okay.
Flesh and sinews should be made from blood, sinews from fibers, and so on. Disrupt that order and disease can take hold.
Like a delicate ecosystem, everything interconnected. One imbalance can have a ripple effect.
And he gets into specifics about different imbalances and the diseases they cause. He talks about bile, for example, and how different types of bile can lead to everything from inflammation and digestive issues to mental disturbances.
I mean, bile can mess with our minds too.
According to Timaeus, yes. He believed that black bile, collecting in the head, could lead to melancholy and even what he called the sacred disease, which we now understand as epilepsy.
Wow, so our physical and mental health are even more closely linked than we might think.
That's a key takeaway from Timaeus. He goes on to describe a whole range of ailments. Fevers, colds, digestive disorders, tumors, gangrene, and explains them as imbalances in the elements and disruptions of the body's natural order.
It's amazing how much he was able to deduce about the human body without the tools and technology we have today.
He even understood the importance of the marrow. He said diseases of the marrow are the most serious, potentially leading to a complete reversal of the body's natural processes.
It's like he was centuries ahead of his time. But what's really fascinating is that Timaeus doesn't stop at the physical. He connects the dots between our health and the state of our society.
Exactly. He argues that bad education and corrupt government can actually contribute to vice and make us more susceptible to illness.
That's a powerful statement. He's saying our social structures have a direct impact on our well-being.
And he takes it even further, suggesting that no one is voluntarily bad.
Okay.
That wickedness arises from a combination of physical predisposition and negative environmental influences.
So it's nature and denurture, not just one or the other.
He's painting a picture of the human being as this incredibly complex entity, shaped by both internal and external forces. And it leads to a central theme of Timaeus, the importance of balance.
Balance in the elements, balance in society, balance within ourselves.
He reminds us that maintaining equilibrium between the body and soul is essential for both health and virtue.
So we can't just focus on one or the other. We need to nurture both our physical and spiritual sides.
Those who dedicate themselves solely to intellectual pursuits need physical exercise, he says. And those focused on bodily health need to cultivate their minds through music and philosophy.
It's a holistic approach to living a good life.
He emphasizes that. The divine part of our soul located in the head is what connects us to the heavens, to those perfect and unchanging forms.
It's a reminder that we have the potential to transcend our limitations and connect with something greater than ourselves.
And by nurturing this divine spark, by contemplating the universe, and aligning our thoughts with that higher order, we can experience true happiness and a kind of immortality.
So it's not just about living a long life. It's about living a meaningful one, a life that resonates with the divine.
Beautifully put. And as he concludes, Timaeus reminds us of that cyclical nature of existence. Those who live virtuously return to their native star, while those who fall short might be reborn, reflecting the choices they made.
It's a call to action, urging us to consider the long-term consequences of our choices and strive for a life of balance and virtue.
And that brings our deep dive into Plato's Timaeus to an end.
Wow, what a journey. From the creation of the universe to the intricacies of the human body and the choices we make that shape our destiny. Timaeus is a true testament to the power of philosophical inquiry.
It leaves us with a lot to ponder, doesn't it? The mysteries of the cosmos, the complexity of the human experience. And that enduring question, what does it mean to live a truly good life?
It's a question worth revisiting again and again as we continue to explore the world and our place within it. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll see you next time for another fascinating exploration of ideas that matter.